know if this thing's high enough or not. Can you hear? My name's Tom Brady, Jr. I'm an alcoholic. And I haven't had a drink since July 20th, 1965. And the least you could have done was get somebody to introduce me besides him. See, Jim frightens me. Jim's one of those deep and profound thinkers. Did you know that? Any of you know that? He has brain damage. He doesn't have but two neurons left up here. And every once in a while they bump together and he has a big brain fart. And that's the extent of his deep thinking. I don't know if y'all know it, but Jim used to be a wino out in Los Angeles. And him and another wino woke up one morning, and Jim punched the guy and said, "I had the best dream I ever had in my life last night." And the other guy said, "What'd you dream?" He said, "I dreamed Mama called me home, gave me $25, told me to go spend the whole day at Disneyland." The other wino said, "You go?" He said, "Yeah, I had a good time. Saw Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck and Goofy and rode all the rides." And the other wino said, "That ain't nothing. I had a better dream than that." And Jim said, "Well, what'd you dream?" He said, "I dreamed I had a luxury apartment, two cases of Jack Daniels. Came a knock on the door, and the two most beautiful women you ever saw came in and started taking their clothes off." And Jim was all caught up in this story. He said, "Why didn't you call me?" The other wino said, "I did. Your mama told me he's at Disneyland." I want to apologize to the afternoon speakers for not being here to hear you. I'm sure you did a good job. I have emphysema, and sometimes what I want to do and what I have to do conflict, and I just had to stop for a while this afternoon, and so that's the reason I wasn't here. And I want to thank y'all for having me back up in Indiana. You're good people up here, and it's amazing and very humbling, truly, all of the people who have thanked me today. For the help that I've apparently given them over the years. And I still don't know how to respond to that, other than to thank God for, you know, using me. Because I'm not a special person. I'm a garden variety drunk. And I have to keep that in mind. And it's amazing what God can do with a bunch of drunks, isn't it? It's amazing. And I'm here for two reasons. One of them's alcohol. And the other one's God. And alcohol beat me down to a point where there was nothing left. There was no fight left in me. I was standing right at death's door, and I knew it. And God picked me up and stood me on my feet and brought me into this bunch of people and has transformed me into an entirely new person. And I bless alcohol. I'm grateful to alcohol. And I'm grateful to God. It's a simple program, this AA stuff, you know. It's not a program based on thought. In my experience, when I start thinking, that just produces more thinking, and that produces more thinking, and that produces more thinking. And one great spiritual teacher said upon one occasion, "Which of you by taking thought could add one cubit to his stature?" And this program is not based on feelings or emotions. It's a spiritual program, and it means it's based on one thing, and that's action. And it's like so many of your sponsors have told you and my sponsor told me, no matter what you think, no matter how you feel, there are certain things you've got to do if you want to stay sober. Now, there are a lot of people in the world still trying to figure out what's wrong with people like you and me. You know? I don't know if you've noticed up in Indiana and North Carolina, all over the country, victimhood is a growth industry. Have you noticed that? God, there's more victims everywhere you turn, there's one, you know? And I know there are victims in this world. God bless them. But I know that from what this program has taught me, that they're going to remain victims until they can bring themselves to forgive those who victimized them. It's their choice. And there's an old boy up in North Carolina who's kind of an egghead type, and I heard him not long ago say that alcoholics are victims too. We're victims of narcissistic wounding. And what we need is self-esteem. And I thought to myself, well, shit. Now, I don't know if anyone ever wounded my Narcissus. I don't know that. I don't even know if I got one, you know. But I know I didn't come into AA to get self-esteem. I came here to survive. And what y'all told me is one of the keys to your survival is you got to stop being a victim, Tom. You got to take responsibility for your life and accountability for your behavior. This is a spiritual program. Responsibility, accountability, all those things that I avoided for so many years, you know. And I don't know about you, I'm kind of tired of victimhood. I wonder what's coming next. Basset Hounditis, I guess, or something like that. But you know, one of my favorite bands is the Eagles. And on their new album, Hell Freezes Over, they got a song about victims, and I kind of like it. So I turn on the tube, what do I see? A whole lot of people crying, don't blame me. They wave their crooked little fingers at everybody else, spend all the time feeling sorry for themselves. Victim of this, victim of that. Your mama's too thin, your daddy's too fat. Get over it. All this whining and crying and pitching a fit, get over it. It's like going to confession. Every time I hear you speak, you're making the most of your losing streak. Some call it sick, but I call it weak. Because you drag it around like a ball and chain. You wallow in the guilt. You wallow in the pain. You wear it, wave it like a flag. Wear it like a crown. Got your mind in the gutter, bringing everybody down. Bitch about the present. Blame it on the past. I'd like to find your inner child and kick his little ass. Get over it. You know, intellectuals don't understand this program. They just don't, you know. When the book Alcoholics Anonymous was published in 1939, it was reviewed by an intellectual for the Journal of the American Medical Association. And he found, and I quote, absolutely nothing of redeeming value in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, end of quote. The other day I was up at the intergroup office in Charlotte, and the secretary handed me this flyer from GSO, and it seems like more than 15 million copies of the big book Alcoholics Anonymous have been sold. It's now translated in 30 languages, sign language, braille, tape, and more people read the big book on a daily basis than any other book in the world aside from the Bible and the Quran. I would submit that it has some kind of redeeming value. But intellectuals just can't bring themselves to understand this thing. You know, it's too simple. You know? Can you imagine me trying to explain my recovery to an intellectual? Well, he said, now you've been sober a long time. You must be a very strong person. And I said, no, sir. I was pretty weak. And when I accepted my weakness, I started getting well. And he would say to me, that makes no sense. And I'd say, I know it doesn't. So, well, what do you do? Well, I go to meetings. He said, oh, group therapy? I said, no, sir, just a bunch of drunks. We get together and talk. Lie a lot, too. And he says, that makes no sense. I said, I know it doesn't. He said, well, what else do you do? I got a sponsor. Ah, a psychotherapist. No, sir, he's a plumber. And he says, that makes no sense. I said, I know it doesn't. Well, what else do you do? Well, we have this program. Ah, now, the great psychologists and metaphysicians and theologians got together and laid you out a path. No, sir, it was put together by a bunch of drunks. That makes no sense. I know it doesn't. Well, who founded this outfit? Well, it was founded by a bankrupt stockbroker and a proctologist who had lost his ass. And he says, that makes no sense. And I said, I know it doesn't. Oh, God. It's just too damn simple. And he says, well, how's it work? I said, it worked real good so far. Ha ha. like to laugh. I believe laughter and tears are God's way to clean out our hearts and clean out our souls. I remember for years I couldn't cry. And when I came in AA, the first 6 months I was here, all I did was cry. All you had to do was say hello to me, I started crying. And I didn't laugh unless it was cynical laugh. If you fell down and hurt yourself, I'd just break up. And one of the nicest things in the world is to be able to laugh and cry. You know, to be human. God, that's a trip, isn't it? Being human. You know? It's a simple program. You know, we're all philosophers. We sit around meetings and try to wow everybody with our profundity and erudition. And I sponsor a boy at home and said, What's that mean? I said, go look it up. He carries a dictionary with him to me. And we just mouth off, you know, about profound things. And we discuss the first three steps, for instance. I bet I've been in 10,000 discussion meetings on the first three steps. Good stuff, man. But it's simplicity itself, you know. When I was a little child, I knew when I was beyond my limits. Y'all did too. And when I was beyond my limits, it was second nature to me to get somebody bigger to help me. And it seemed like when I do that, the situation would get handled. Okay? I remember this kid I grew up with, his name was Ronnie. He's the filthiest kid I ever saw in my life. You could smell him coming two blocks away. Ronnie picked boogers out of his nose, put them in his hair, and spin them, and stuck up all over his head. Ronnie is a good baseball player. We put him on shortstop and say, play deep, Ronnie, play real deep. His mom and daddy were street drunks. He didn't have anybody to take care of him. I liked Ronnie a lot. I was scared of him. I was always scared of him. But I'd take him home with me sometimes. Mother would meet us on the porch with two tubs, one for his clothes and one for him before he'd ever go in the house. And he'd stay with us sometime a week. And he loved my mom and daddy. I could beat Ronnie at two things. I could beat him shooting marbles, and I could outrun him, which was good because I was scared of him. And marbles are simple. You shoot marbles, if you win, you get all the marbles. Those are the rules. And I'd win, and Ronnie would take my marbles. Every time. Well, I was scared of Ronnie. So I go get my daddy. I said, Daddy, Ronnie got my marbles. He said, you win, son? I'd say, yes, sir. He'd say, that's not right. Let's go get them. And we'd go over to Ronnie's, and I think Ronnie stole my marbles just to get to see my daddy. Because he'd say, son, you got Tommy's marbles? He said, yes, sir. Did you win? No, sir. That's not right. Give them back. Okay. Now, let's examine the first three steps. First step says I've lost my marbles. And I can't get them back. Second step says, but I know if I get somebody bigger, I have a chance of getting them back. And third step says you turn it over to the bigger one and you got your marbles back. There's nothing really profound about that, is it? You know? And sometimes I and others of us, you know, get all screwed around on what this deal's all about. We got the best textbook on the face of God's earth. It says in the beginning of that book, we have Alcoholics Anonymous of more than 100 who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. It's the purpose of this book to explain precisely how we recovered. Precisely. And they go on to do so. And I'm one of those who believes that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a system. And if I fulfill the conditions of that system, then the things that happen to the ones who wrote that book shall happen to me. That's what they promised. And if I don't fulfill the conditions of that system, there's no way these things can happen to me. And I was always one of those people, the system applied to you, not me. I always wanted to beat the system or go around the system somehow. And it just doesn't work that way. Y'all ever get bored with Alcoholics Anonymous? You ever get bored with doing the same thing over and over and over and over again? I did. But redundancy is the way that we learn. Redundancy is the way characters change. A friend of mine says, you sow a thought, you reap an act. You sow an act, you reap a habit. You sow a habit, you reap a character. It's the truth. I can't change one thing about me by thinking, but through action, over and over and over and over again, certain things become second nature to me. Sometimes I wish they didn't. I used to get hold of depression for weeks, man. When I get depressed by the tail, I let it drag the ground. I want you to damn well know I'm depressed. So you'd ask me, are you depressed? So I could tell you ain't none of your damn business. You know, I can't maintain a depression anymore. Because I know better. It's uncomfortable. And there are certain things I do which have saved my life through the years. These redundant, boring kinds of things. God, do I have to go to that meeting? Again? With those people? I don't like them anyway. Yeah, you got to go. And AA has become to me not a bunch of people. It's become my family. And it's the greatest family on the face of God's earth. And I love being with my brothers and I love being with my sisters. And it's the first place on earth, and this is the truth, that I ever really felt that I truly belonged. You know? That I truly matched what was going on. Now I'm an alcoholic, and what I mean by that is I've always believed that anything that feels good should be done to excess. If it feels good, overdo it. So I've had problems with a lot of things. Sometimes I eat too much. You know, I eat a big meal and you say, oh boy, that's good, and then you're dying for the next 3 days. And sometimes I overdo doing nothing. I've had trouble with sex. Any of y'all have trouble with sex? I remember when I found out it felt good. I was by myself just like all of y'all were. And in spite of some dire warnings from my mother, a certain part of my anatomy was going to rot off. And I was going to go blind. I figured it felt so good I'd keep on until it was nearsighted. And I succeeded in that effort. When I say I'm an alcoholic, I mean it's... I'm like the Tasmanian devil sometimes. Y'all ever get that way? You're like a ping pong ball. You got to do everything at one time, do it all perfectly. You ever try to pee and comb your hair at the same time? Kind of messy, ain't it? Now, I've always been a great starter and a poor finisher. I've had two basic speeds, fast forward and stop. Doesn't seem like a big problem, does it? Man, when I was hurting because of alcohol, fast forward. I want help. I want it now. Help me, help me, help me, help me. Now I start feeling better, and I put it on stop and go right back and did what made me hurt in the first place. You see, people come in the doors of our program, and they're dying, and they're wanting help, and they really are. And in 10 days, they disappear. Why? Because things got good. If I had a worse enemy in my life than things going bad, it was things going good. Because I had this knack of when things were going good, pulling the whole thing down around my head like the big book says. When things get good, that can be bad. That's when complacency sets in. That's when the little monkey jumps on my shoulder again and says, uh-huh, you don't need to go to that meeting tonight. No, you don't need to call your sponsor. No, you don't need to read the big book. You're doing okay, boy. And first thing you know, I'm in bad shape. Now, I'm an alcoholic. I've always been in a hurry, and I wanted a quick fix. I've always believed in magic, and the reason for that is I'm lazy. And I talk to alcoholics, and I say, I'm not lazy. I worked 80 hours this week. Ain't talking about that. How many meetings you go to? Oh, I didn't have time. How much you reading the big book? Oh, well, did you talk to your sponsor? No. Then you're lazy. It's amazing how hard I work to be an alcoholic. There's no harder job. And I expected sobriety to be a slide. Give it to me and give it to me now. Fix me, God, with your magic wand. As soon as my ass warms the seat in AA, I want 10 years sobriety, and I want it right now. Effortlessly. Got news for you. Ain't no magic. And magic, by definition, is illusion. It don't last. And all these things, I didn't say I was this way. I am this way. I've always seen things in either-or terms. You know, either I'm the best or I'm the worst. Either it's up or it's down, you know? And all of life is somewhere in the middle. I remember going to an Alamine meeting one night, and some of these ladies know me, you know, and they said, "Tom, would you talk to us about balance?" I said, "I'd be glad to if you'd tell me what it is." I said, "It must be that point that I pass on the way from one extreme to the other." Balance. It ain't even in my dictionary. Moderation never was in my dictionary. I went whole hog at everything. Now, I'm an alcoholic, and that quite simply means this. I live in a body that won't handle alcohol. It never would. Every time I put alcohol in this body sent me a message. And the message was quite clear and quite demanding. Get some more of that stuff and get it right now. That's what my body said to me. Now, science tells me that this is because I have a biochemical genetic disorder having to do with the hypothalamic information control center in my brain. Y'all understand that? I don't either. That's the reason I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. They say, "You're allergic to alcohol." You know, I had a problem with my mind. And the scientists tell me it's because I have this narcissistic, egocentric core dominated by feelings of omnipotence, intent at all costs on maintaining its own inner integrity. Alcoholics Anonymous says, "You're strangely insane." Take your pick. And then we come to the point that differentiates Alcoholics Anonymous from all other attempts to help an alcoholic. The big book says, we've been mentally and physically ill, but we've been spiritually sick also. And then it says an astounding thing, y'all. Once the spiritual malady is overcome, then we straighten out mentally and physically. Spiritual malady. In the world is that? You know, in my mind, I've always been an idealist and a perfectionist, a hypersensitive romantic dreamer. And I never was satisfied with life or me or you like it was. I always wanted more. And in order to have things my way, and it scared me to death if I didn't have things going my way. I manipulated you, and I conned you, and I used you, and I lied to you. And when you do that to other people, they want to gain some control also. And a wall came up between me and my brothers and my sisters. And when I got a wall between me and my brothers and my sisters, I'm convinced there's a wall also between me and my God. And I became separated and isolated and disconnected from man and God because of my efforts to control. And when you're disconnected, and y'all know what I'm talking about, you know loneliness like you ain't ever imagined loneliness being. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that these drunks gave us says quite simply, if you quit trying to control people, you know, and take a look at that wall that you've built, and take out the stones in it that separate you from your brothers and your sisters and your God, and walk through and join up with them and repair the damage you've done in the past, God will restore your sanity. And if God restores your sanity, you won't drink again. And if you don't drink again, your body cannot send you that message. That's utter simplicity. Because you see, this strange insanity the program of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about is not mental illness in the normal sense of that word. It has very little to do with my neurons. What strange insanity means to me is I've become separated from that which I must not be separated from. That lack of power is my dilemma. And I must reconnect. And if I reconnect, I will be restored to sanity. And that's been the case with me. And I'm a fearful person. I've been afraid as far back as I can remember in my life. I wouldn't admit it to you, but I was scared to death. That's where my need to control came from, Charlie. I had to have it my way or it scared me to death. And people talk about fear of this and fear of that. I've come to believe there's just one fear. But it's got a lot of legs, like a big octopus, you know. And that's the way AA approaches it. As one piece, you know. How do we deal with fear? We outgrow it. We don't work on it, live through it. We outgrow it by taking certain actions. Okay? Again, the word action. Now, I had a lot to be afraid about. I was the ugliest baby you ever saw. People ask me how I know that, and my mama told me that. That's how I know. She said, son, I never saw an ugly baby until you was born. And I wouldn't take you out of the house the first 6 weeks you was on earth. I didn't want nobody to see you. And I told a psychiatrist that one time, and he said, fool, that must have been traumatic for you. I said, no, sir, it wasn't traumatic. I've seen my baby pictures. Mama's right. I was ugly. As I grew up, things didn't get much better. I was one of them skinny little old boys, you know. If I turned sideways, I looked like a tricycle ready to ride off. My shoulder blades protruded out so far, and I'd try to compensate by bringing my shoulders around, and then my chest would disappear. And Mama made me wear knickers. Any of you fellas had to wear knickers? My leg was this big, and the knicker hole was this big, and it was always falling down, and I hated those knickers. Somebody said to me not long ago, knickers are coming back. I said, no, my ass ain't. And I love freckles on other people. Man, I didn't like them on me. I had them all over my body, from the top of my head to the soles of my feet. I had freckles where people have never reported having freckles before. And I didn't like them. And I didn't like being skinny. No, and ugly. On top of that, I always wanted to be a macho man, big and strong and tough. My mother had four big brothers, and they were all macho. And the most macho in the bunch was my Uncle Durwood. They called him Dud, Uncle Dud. And Uncle Dud was a motorcycle cop back in the days when they wore riding breeches and leather spats up to their knees, and he had a harness across here with silver bullets in it, you know, and a pearl handle 38 sitting high on his hip. He smelled like gunpowder and shaving lotion, and he squeaked when he walked. And that's macho. And you know what all my macho uncles call me? I had this great shock of snow white hair, and they all call me Puddinhead. Now, it's hard to be macho when people call you Puddinhead. And my Uncle Dud, you know, is 87 years old now. He's still the most macho man I've ever known in my life. You know? I remember back when I was riding behind Uncle Dud on that Harley Davidson police motorcycle with my arms around him. I wasn't afraid. It was the only time I wasn't afraid. You know? Even then, you see, I needed a higher power. Uncle Dud was and is one of my heroes. And we need heroes in this program. We do not need idols in this program. There is a difference. Idols are those poor men and women, you know, because they've got a gift for speaking or something else. We put them up on a pedestal and watch them and demand perfection of them. And the first little mistake that they make, we destroy them. Which is the reason you build idols anyway. Now, heroes are people who get out there and do it, man. And they make mistakes and they have successes. Whichever they have is okay. They keep on doing it. They get up when they make a mistake. They wipe the bruises. They wipe the blood off themselves. And they go and do it again. Say, I made a mistake. God, if it weren't for you, I'd do it all the time. Heroes are those who accept themselves precisely the way that they are. And I wouldn't be alive tonight were it not for my heroes in this program. And I'm going to tell you, most of them are dead, but they ain't. You understand what I mean? As long as I walk the face of this earth, Bob's alive and Chuck's alive and Harry's alive. Because they are me. You understand that? They've given me. And not a one of them was perfect. Not a one of them. And neither am I. And you know, it's a great relief. When I can look at myself and I can say, you know, Tom, there's a lot of light in you, but there's a lot of dark too. And it's okay. I was telling Charlie this afternoon, somebody said to me not long ago, said, some people think you're a saint and some people think you're a son of a bitch. Which one are you? I said, I'm both of them. I'm both of them. And the way I put it is, it's okay to be a dipshit if you can accept the fact that you're a dipshit. I hated my mother for years. My mother was a very dominant woman. My mother would have breathed for me if she could. I remember I had a bad automobile accident up in West Virginia back in 1964. I did one of those wonderful alcoholic things in a blackout. I drove under a tractor trailer. I was in traction up there in the hospital for over 3 months. I was unconscious for 3 weeks. And when I came to after 3 weeks, my mother was standing beside the bed, and she said the following words, son, how could you do this to me? Okay? Now, that gives you reason to blame and hate, doesn't it? And I hated my mother for years, you see? She tried to relive her life through me. Now, I could get into the blame game and stay in it forever. I was my mama's victim. Even a psychiatrist told me that about a mama like yours. I'd drink, too. You know something? I've learned some different things. Mama and I got to get along pretty good, you know. Mama's a black belt Southern Baptist. You understand what I mean? There's one way to do everything. Mama get up 4:30 in the morning and give God his directions for the day. She called it praying, but I knew better than that, you know. Read 10 chapters of the Bible because Billy Graham said to do it that way. You know, you slept past 6 o'clock in the morning, you were a sinner in my house. Let me tell you something. Mama didn't know how to overtly express her love. The last 5 years of her life, she had Alzheimer's. And she hugged and kissed me constantly. But she never knew but one way to love me. And that was to bail me out. You know? Let me tell you something. Mother's dead now. If I asked my mother to come to this place tonight and die for me, my mother would be there. Y'all hear what I'm saying? People don't all know how to show love in any other way. And we assume that they don't like us or they don't love us, and you can almost feel them struggling inside, you know, to reach out and do it, but they've been so indoctrinated in another way they can't do it. And I revere my mother. I revere her memory. She's running heaven now. God don't have a chance. I'll tell you that right now. You know, he ain't got a chance when Mama got there. And God, what a woman. And how powerfully she influenced my life for the good. But you know, for a long time, when I look back at my childhood, I couldn't see that. All I could ever see with this alcoholic mind of mine, you know, was what Mom and Daddy didn't do. Okay? I could see where you fell short. I could pick out the shortcomings in everybody here tonight. If you're an alcoholic, you can do that. It won't take but a few seconds. I can go look in a mirror and do the same thing, by the way. Because it works two ways. My childhood wasn't that bad. I was born in a little textile mill town down in North Carolina. Everybody on the worker's side of the street, you know, was family to me. The people that were management lived on the other side of the street, you know, in 2- and 3-story houses. And we all had houses just alike. But we were family. I don't mean we had the same names, but I mean I ate at your house, I slept at your house, if I misbehaved at your house, I got punished at your house. And punishment was swift and sure. There was no abuse to it. What they told us in this little mill village was, boy, if you do that, I'll whoop your ass. That's the way they put it. I'm sorry. And when you did it, guess what they did? And there was no appeal. And that's when I first started hearing Mama talk. Y'all remember Mama talk? What your mama says to you don't make no sense? Mama would be switching my legs and saying, son, remember this hurts me worse than it hurts you. Never have understood that. Always wanted to say to her, Mama, give me that stick. You know, let me use it on you. I don't want you hurting Mama. And I loved everybody on that block. The lady next door was the best cook on the block, and her name was Lena. And she's the best eater on the block, too. Lena was a heavy woman, you know. I just loved to hug Lena. When you hug Lena, you had a breast in both ears. And she rubbed me on the head and said, I love you, Puddin'. And I just go, And there wasn't anything sexual about it. You know what I mean? It was like being enveloped with warm, fleshy love. I mean, it was wonderful. She's here tonight. I'd again. And her son, Bill Jr., one of them little boys programmed for self-destruction. You know, you never saw him unless something was broken or stitched or cut or, you know, if he's within 10 yards of your car, you didn't shut the door, his hand would be in it. And when Bill was taking a bath, if his mama turned her back, he'd escape. And she'd come out on the front porch and say, Puddin, he's loose again. There go Bill's naked ass down the street. It's my job to catch him, you know. And then there was John Q. and there was Martha, the first little girl I ever played doctor with. I've never forgotten her. Y'all remember playing doctor? Don't tell me you don't. This is an honest program. I can tell you where we did it and how we did it right now. And old man Lucas used to come by the house with his old wheelbarrow, you know, old wooden wheelbarrow with the wire wheel on front of it. And he'd be going down to slop the hogs. He'd call me, and I'd jump in that wheelbarrow. We'd ride down to the hog pen, you know. And I'd go wading in the creek, and I'd catch some crawdads and drink me some cold water out the creek, you know. And life was good when I was a kid. And sometimes I'd walk home along that road and I'd think, man, this is good. Isn't it pretty? Isn't it all beautiful? When I was a child, I was in awe of things. This was a wonderful place. You know? And I go home and lay down on the grass sometimes, look up at the sky. Y'all remember doing that? And say, God, that's pretty. Wonder who made it. Y'all remember? That's a nice cloud. Wonder where it came from. Wonder where it's going. And I get up and go about my business. And you know, it's a funny thing. In this program, the things I believed as a little boy, I believe now. And the things I rejected as a little boy, I still reject. It's almost like coming full circle again through the program. Okay? I used to go to the movie every Saturday. It didn't cost but 9 cents. The man next door ran the theater. And popcorn was a nickel a box. Some of y'all are old enough to remember this. You won't admit it, I know, but you're old enough. And you run out of popcorn, you stick your box back out there. I spend the whole day at the movies. You know what I see? For 9 cents, I'd see 2 Westerns, okay, and 2 good serials like Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers. Those were the original spacemen, you know, and some good cartoons. I mean, Bugs Bunny and Porky Pig, not this monster stuff you see on TV now. I could see Wile E. Coyote, who's one of my role models. And I'd sit in that movie, and cowboys were my heroes, man, you know. You remember Hopalong Cassidy and the Durango Kid and Sunset Carson and Rocky Lane and Charles Sterrett and Wild Bill Elliott. Any of y'all remember Wild Bill Elliott wore 2 6-guns, silver 6-guns turned backwards. You draw down on Wild Bill, he'd spin them old 6-guns and shoot the guns out of your hands. See, cowboys was polite in those days. They didn't have to blow your guts all over the screen, you know what I mean? And you spin them guns back in there and walk off looking all macho. You know, I love it. And my favorite cowboy was a dude named Lash LaRue. And they called him Lash because, now you youngins are going to have to watch TBS some morning about 4 o'clock. You might see Lash. And Lash carried a bullet whip. And when you drew down on Lash, he whooped the gun out of your hand. I mean, Lash was cool. And I was watching Lash one day, and he'd stand up on the roof of the saloon, you know, and he'd run all the bad guys out of town. He'd stand there looking macho, you know. And he popped his whip and whistled, and his horse come running by. Popped that whip again, and he leapt into the saddle and rode off in the sunset, popping that whip, and tears come to my eyes. I said, God, that's wonderful. Look at Lash. And I watched it again and again and again. And he was my hero, and you got to emulate your heroes. So I went home, got me a piece of rope, went up on the garage. And a little boy next door had a pony named Beauty. I said, John, you go saddle up Beauty. And he did. I said, now walk her past the garage. And I popped my rope and I whistled and I leapt into the saddle. And when I hit it, you could have heard me screaming, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Now, I don't know if that was a spiritual experience, but I've never forgotten it. I'll tell you that. You know, 30 minutes later, when I got my breath back, I began to wonder about Lash LaRue. I'll tell you. I used to think in my special place like most of you did. You know, mine was in a chinaberry tree. We called them Cheney ball trees where I was from. And I'd sit up there and do my deep thinking. Now, deep thinking as a little boy was just kind of watching my thoughts go through my head. And I'd think about my daddy. My daddy's the finest man ever walked the face of the earth. He's the sweetest, gentlest, kindest, goodest man I've ever known. And I adore him to this day. And he's my number one hero. If I ever want to be like anybody, it's like my daddy. And I think about my daddy, and I think about my mother, and my sister, and all my friends, and how fortunate I was, really. I didn't like me, but they were nice, you know? And then I think to myself, something's missing, and I don't know what it is. But I know if I ever find it, everything's going to be okay. It was like having a big empty place inside of me, you know, that needed filling. Carl Jung had a beautiful way of describing it. He said, the secret unrest that gnaws at the roots of your being. You know? And I had this, even as a little boy. I was longing for something. I didn't know what I was longing for. And I know today that it was a longing which is very human, to reconnect with that which created me. I know that. And to me, that's the essence of spirituality, a longing to connect with the one who created me. Now, I'm going to tell you this, and I don't usually tell it, but I'll tell it tonight. Sunday mornings around my house with a black belt Southern Baptist mother were a real Sunday. When you're Baptist, you go to church all the time. You know what I mean? And Sunday morning, Mama put on her war clothes. That's what I call them.
She always wore a dark blue or black dress, which made me believe that God liked dark colors, you know. And Mama go in the bedroom, and Mama put on a corset. I'm not talking about a girdle. I'm talking about a corset, one of the things you string up in the back. And Mama go in, I could hear her letting all her breath out and stringing up that corset. And she had a brassiere with hormones, and she'd string that thing on, put on that black dress, come out of that room, could not breathe, couldn't move nothing, but her head looked like a buzzard sitting on a fence, you know. I said, Mama, what'd you do? You're a good-looking woman. What'd you do that for? And here's Mama talk, because it's Sunday. I figured that out. I'm a smart kid. Sunday means church. Church means God. God does not want my mother to breathe on Sunday. I was sitting in that little wooden Baptist church one Sunday morning when I was 9 years old. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it was like the nicest, warmest shower came down around me I'd ever felt in my life. And I started crying, and chill bumps started spreading all over me. And I said to myself, whatever it was that was missing, ain't missing no more. This is it. And I hope this feeling never goes away. And it was gone. It's a real spiritual experience. I don't need to tell you how many times I went back to church and sat in that same seat to make sure to. Heard the same preacher, same choir, sat beside the same mother who couldn't breathe. And it never happened again. When I was 15 years old, I drank some of the foulest tasting stuff I've ever had in my life. The label on the bottle said Cream of Kentucky. It's incredible how I followed directions from the beginning as far as drinking was concerned. When the cab driver bought us this foul stuff, I said to my friend Egghead Baker, Egghead, what do we do with this stuff? And he said, Tommy, you drink a water glass of it as fast as you can. Then you drink a glass of water, and then you do it again. I stood in front of the bathroom mirror, and I watched myself take my first drink. And I can picture it now. Okay? You know what happened? It was like the nicest, warmest shower came down all around me. And I said to myself, this is it. I'm never going to be without this stuff again. How many of y'all felt that way? See, the effects of what has historically been called spirits is a spiritual experience. I love it when people say alcoholics are trying to escape from reality. We're running from this. We're running from that. Maybe we are. But mainly we're running after that feeling again. And I was saying to myself, this time it'll be different. This time if I just handle it right, I'm going to be able to control and enjoy my drinking. Which, as I understand, is a great obsession of every abnormal drinker. And I was one immediately. I blacked out the first night. By the time I was 16 or 17, I was being locked up in the Wake County Jail on a very regular basis. My daddy on the board of deacons for 50 years. My mother, hostess of the Tabernacle Baptist Church. And I'm appearing on those social pages, you know. Drunk and disorderly, drunk and this and drunk and that. I never, ever remember being locked up a single time. But I remember coming to in jail every time. And this kept on until by the time I was 23 years old, I had over 1,000 stitches taken in my face alone as a result of drinking. Okay. And I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous, but I showed up believing in magic, wanting an instant fix, hurting, and wanting it done now. And I came in Alcoholics Anonymous like I'd always done everything else. Let's get in here and get it fixed and get it over with and move on to whatever's next. I got a good mind. I always had a good mind, and that was almost my downfall, because in school it was easy for me. I could memorize and picture my notes in my mind, you know, and when I took a test, I just matched what was in my mind with what was on the paper. I went through college with a 3.94 average, and I was president of everything. I was soloist with the college choir. I had my own dance band. Who's who among students in American universities and college, junior and senior year. Outstanding biblical student. That's pretty good for a drunk, and I was drunk 75% of the time. And I learned nothing, but it was that facade, that stage character of the book. I had a good one. I had a good one. And I came to you that way. An intellectual wreck. And I saw 12 steps on one placard and 12 traditions on another. And a guy standing up front with a blue book, and everybody was listening to him. And I said, all I got to do is memorize what's there, memorize what's there, memorize what's in that big blue book. And they'll put me up front, and I'll be in charge of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, don't tell me you haven't thought the same thing. Don't tell me that. Because I like control, even to this day. Okay? And I know if I pull the bus of life into this room tonight, everybody in here would go for the steering wheel. Al-Anon's first, probably. And I memorized it. And I can quote large portions of the book to you right now, but I no longer have to. And that's one of the great freedoms. As long as I was just a stage character, that was part of my front. For the next 7 years, with all this knowledge, okay, listen to me, you eggheads out there, you thinkers. The longest I stayed dry was 89 days in 7 years. You hear me? Now I know it was 89 days, because up in North Carolina we give out a red poker chip when you've been sober 90 days, and I got one. I used to go up the chip box after the meeting and steal the damn things. I was so sick of me. I was so sick of being a nobody, a nothing. And that red chip would make me somebody. Now I know it doesn't. It's a symbol, that's all. If there's nothing going on inside, that symbol means absolutely nothing. But I took one and I pasted it on the 90th day on a calendar. And I very gingerly went over all the steps and picked the one I figured would do it for me. And it was the meditation part of the 11th step. I knew how to pray. I'm a Baptist, you know. I prayed my ass off all my life. And I knew how to do that. And I found out who the great meditators were. And they're these guys that shave all the hair off their heads, you know, and wear these orange bathrobes and fold up their legs real funny and sit down on the ground and chant. Now, mind you, that's an ancient and honored and wonderful tradition. I'm not knocking it. But when the village idiot tries it, and I wasn't interested in the process, the discipline, don't tell me about discipline, I saw the results. I always wanted the results without making the effort. I'm too vain to shave all the hair off my head. I couldn't find an orange bathrobe anywhere. And so I wore my old blue terrycloth drinking liquor bathrobe with a cigarette burns in it. You know the one? Y'all probably had one. You know? And I've broken my leg so many times driving my car into things that you're not supposed to drive into that I could get into lotus position, but I couldn't get out of it. Plus, it hurt. I'd get my wife to help me into lotus position, and I was going to chant my way to sobriety by God. Now, I don't know much about God, and today I don't think it's very necessary that I do. I think God's meant to be talked to and not talked about. God's incomprehensible intellectually, and yet in my heart, I can be closer to Him than anybody on the face of this earth. And I was far from a man. But God's got a sense of humor. I see Him now standing up there looking down, Him and Peter, you know. He says, Peter, there He is again. And Peter says, who, God? He said, Puddinhead. He down there squatted down again, you know, he's got on that old dirty bathrobe. I wish he'd get rid of that thing. I'd smell it clear up here. And tell me, Peter, what does mean anyway? Days I chanted it. On the 90th day, I rested. People gave up hope on me. I met some ugly people in alcoholics. Now, I'm just the ugliest people I've ever seen in my life. They were profane. All of them was ugly. They talked in circles. They were stupid. And they called them old-timers. This old boy from Burlington, North Carolina, named Bill C. He's one of my heroes today. I called him grumpy. I hated his guts. He'd wait for me at meetings. He denied it, but he was lying. As soon as I come in the door, his fingers go at me. Boy, how you doing? Oh, God, I hated that. And I'd tell him, I'm fine. And he'd back me into the corner and tell me how I was. That's scary, you know that? And he talked in circles. Didn't make a bit of sense. Boy, you can't think your way into good living. You got to live your way into good thinking. I think to myself, shut up, you ugly old bastard. I'm smarter than you are. But I didn't say anything to him because I was scared of him. And boy, how come you always running around looking for God? God ain't lost. Oh, I love that one. Grumpy tried his best to help me. You know? I'd be on help. Because I wasn't whooped yet. I used to call for help when it was too late. Y'all ever do that? Test pattern go out on TV, you know, and all the liquor's gone. Shit, it's time for help now, ain't it? I called old Grumpy one morning about 3 o'clock in the morning. He didn't let me say a word. Before I could say a word, he said, boy, don't you ever call me drunk again. He said, matter of fact, don't you ever call me again. If you want to get sober, you know where we meet. Don't call me to come get you. You can walk. And he said, frankly, I don't care if you ever get sober. I'm a very sensitive person. That hurt my feelings. And I cussed him for everything on the face of the earth, and I bless him today. And he never changed. The last time I saw him, he was dying of cancer. And I walked into his hospital room, and I've been sober 16 years. And down came the finger. And he said, boy, you'll never make it. You know, I wish we had more grumpies around. He was a no BS guy. Well, I drank on until I guess I couldn't drink anymore. And I came to on or about July 20th, 1965, and I say on or about because my wife and I picked my sobriety date because neither one of us thought I was going to stay sober. And I knew I couldn't drink, and I knew I couldn't quit, and I knew I was going to die. I was a college professor. I was about to lose my job. I was on 5 years probation. I had 2 years on the chain gang. I was never supposed to drive a car in the state of North Carolina again. And I walked. I made a profit out of drunkenness. I walked back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Like James Taylor says in one of his songs, I guess my feet know where they want me to go. God bless my feet. My head kept me in trouble. My feet brought me to you. Knowing in my head that you couldn't help me. Isn't it with something? But I kept coming. Grumpy was later to tell me the only thing I ever did right in Alcoholics Anonymous, so I kept coming back. I came late and I left early. I didn't say anything, and I scared deaf people. I was more scared of God. I figured God was like human beings, you know, with all the stuff I had done, he must hate me, and he's just waiting to zap me any chance he gets. And God's not that way. But I kept going. And people started saying, we're glad you're here. We need you. And then it made me shiver. We love you. Oh, God, that scared me. And I thought, if they knew me, they wouldn't be saying this. And I didn't have to walk to any more meetings. They found out I was walking, and a car pulled up in front of my house every single night, and the horn would blow, and I was off to a meeting. They called me. Strangers called me. I didn't have to call them. What's changing in Alcoholics Anonymous? Too many times I look around a group, and I see the people in the meeting giving the guy their number and saying, call me. They didn't do that. You know, the members called the one who needed the help. Think about it. It was called group sponsorship. Is it still alive in Indiana? You know? And I stayed sober for a while. And I got walking around one night and I saw this guy in the meeting. I liked the way he moved. And I'm not going to lie about it. I was impressed by his clothing and by his Lincoln Continental and by his big cigars, too. But the thing that impressed me the most was this man seemed to be walking what he was talking. And I eased up to him one night, and I said, I'm Tom, and I don't want to die. Would you be my sponsor? And he turned on me and pointed his finger at me and said, boy, I've heard about you. They tell me you're not just an alcoholic. They tell me you're crazy. But I'll help you on one condition. I said, what's that? He said, we'll do it my way. And I don't know but one way, and it's in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. You want to do that for me? And I said, I didn't even believe this. Yes, sir. Up until that point in time, anyone who told me anything like that would get a violent reaction out of me. And I said, yes, sir. And then he got stupid on me. You ever notice how your sponsor seems so wise and all-knowing, and you ask him to be your sponsor, and he goes stupid on you immediately? And he said, I want you to come to meetings early, and I want you to shake everybody's hand and ask them how they're doing. I said, I don't want to come to meetings early. I don't want to shake their hand. I don't care how they're doing. I just don't want to die. And why do I have to do that? And he said, boy, you don't ask me why. You do what I tell you to do. So many of these people come out of treatment centers now, and they've had a counselor. You know? And they confuse a sponsor with a counselor. Two different animals, folks. I got a master's degree in counseling. I hope you're impressed by that, because I'm not. And if I told you to do that as a counselor, my next statement would be, how does that make you feel? My sponsor didn't give a happy shit how it made me feel. Didn't seem to. And no one cared more for my feelings than he did. But he knew that no matter how I felt, here we go again, no matter what I thought about what he told me, following directions was the key because it meant I had surrendered. Now you talk to me about surrender all night in the most beautiful words you want to. If you ain't following directions, you ain't surrendered. And I didn't know I'd surrendered. That was a beautiful thing. If I'd have known it, I'd have screwed it up. I'm too run down even to think. Thank God for that. Hey, say, read pages so and so. I said, I can't do it. I said, I can't remember one sentence when I get to the next one. And he said, well, son, why don't you just read that one sentence and think about it a little bit. You have been demanding more of yourself than you could give your entire life. Why don't you cut yourself some slack? Damn, that's a novel concept for a perfectionist. And boy, he mothered me. Oh. And I went and I shook hands. And I looked at the floor. I hope to God I never forget this. I didn't touch people. People scared me. And I was shaking hands. And I was looking at feet. And then I saw some ankles. A few weeks I saw some shins, you know. And then some thighs. Then some hips. Beautiful hips. Oh, God, beautiful hips. And then after a few more weeks, I was looking them in the eye, and I was glad to see them, and I did care how they were doing. And you know what happened? It's like the nicest, warmest shower came down on me. And that's the only way I can describe it. And I kind of softened and, you know, took that deep breath. Like, I'm home. And it asked me to read, and I couldn't not cry. So they let me pick up ashtrays. And then they let me clean coffee cups. They had real coffee cups. They let me wash those. That was fantastic to me. They're allowing me. And before you know it, I'm walking around with a key to a Baptist church in my pocket. How's that for a drunk? Little stuff, ain't it? No, it ain't. The biggest stuff in the world. And one day I'm sitting at work at the college, and all of a sudden it dawns on me. Tom, you haven't worn the drink in over 3 months. Wow. And I cried. What else do you do? And I didn't know why that was, but I knew it had something to do with my following directions. I knew it had something to do with that. We were talking about the third step in a meeting on Tuesday night, and people were talking about how they took the third step, and they got on their knees with their sponsors, and it was beautiful and everything. I said, I wish I could remember. You know, I wish mine had been that beautiful and classic, but it wasn't. When I took the third step, I sat on the side of my bed and I read that prayer over and over and over and over again because I was scared to death I'd miss a comma or a period and I'd die. And now when I sponsor somebody, I get on my knees with them and we do that third step prayer, you see? But it ain't doing it perfect. Listen to me, you perfectionists. It's the willingness and the effort that counts. My sponsor kept saying to me, God, I want to strangle him. Effort, result, effort, result, effort, result. You don't understand the spiritual way of life, and then do it, and then you might understand it. And he's right. He was never wrong. I'd do things he told me just to prove him wrong. And I went through the steps according to the directions. That's the only way he let me do it. And I remember sitting in, you know, a chapel down St. Simon's Island in Georgia one day after I'd taken the seventh step, and I was looking up at this stained glass window, and there was the carpenter, you know, and there was no cross. And thought came in my mind, where's the cross? No thought came. It's been removed, Tom, and yours has too. And I cried. I didn't get a huge spiritual light, but these little nudges that told me, hey man, things are different. Something's working for you. Whatever it is, keep on doing it. And I continue to this day. I'm not going to stop. I looked for the ultimate high all my life. And I had to almost die to discover that the ultimate high is the natural high. And it's called sobriety. Yeah. Ain't that a hoot? There's so much to be learned and there's so much to do. I used to be impressed, so impressed, with the major principles. Let's talk about absolute honesty. I don't know nothing about absolute honesty. Let's talk about absolute purity. What the hell is that? And I've gotten away from that. I go through my life every day, and I try to make no difference in the way that I treat you and AA and the people out on the street. No difference in those I'm working with, and those I'm working for. And I simply try to be as nice and kind and gentle and considerate as I can possibly be. And my definition of success has changed. I don't have a lot of money. Don't need a lot. Wouldn't mind having it. I'm not against it. But don't need a lot. If I put my head on the pillow tonight and say, Tom, did you try to be kind and gentle and polite and considerate to everyone today? And I can say yes, then I'm an unqualified success in a spiritual sense, and there is no other that matters. And life has changed. Because you see, this 12-step program, in case you hadn't noticed, is the finest and most effective life-changing program on the face of God's earth. I follow directions, and all of those promises have come true in my life. Okay? All of them. I used to think that what happened to me would change. Any of you ever think that way? And I'd get mad because bad things were still happening to me. And it's, you know, it's not what happens to me in this life that matters. It's my reaction to it that makes the difference. Emmett Fox, Charlie, with a new difficulty of any kind, it's the reception I give it mentally and the attitude I take toward it in my own thought that completely determine its effect on me. Last 5 years of my life have been a bitch. I've had 6 or 7 surgeries, one of them for cancer. The woman I adored walked out on me. I almost went bankrupt. I've got emphysema, high blood pressure, deep venous thrombophlebitis. I'm a walking time bomb. You know? And after she walked out on me, I wanted to die. It's like my whole life walked out when she walked out, and I realized again how easy it was for me, because of the kind of person I am, to put all my eggs in somebody else's basket. And I was hurting. My sponsor's got Alzheimer's also, and my mom's got Alzheimer's by this time. And I'm thinking, God, what's going to happen next? And I called this guy, and I said, I need a sponsor. And I've been sober longer than he has, but I love him. He's just as down to earth as spit. And he said, okay, I'll help you if you'll be my sponsor. I said, okay, we'll sponsor. I said, I'm not capable of sponsoring anybody right now. I am really sick. He said, I know. And he said to me, hey, Tom, I can't solve your problems. I've run around looking for answers to my problem, and I can't answer your question. But we can go to a meeting tonight. I said, I won't go to a meeting. He said, that's where you were going. And you need to get out of yourself. You need to work with some other people. And I turned loose everybody I was sponsoring because I wasn't capable of sponsoring. I was crazy. And he said, you need a couple of them. Get a couple of them right quick. I said, I don't want to. He said, good reason. Go get them. And he walked me right back to the basics of this program, and it started lifting. And about the time it lifted, my mother died, and this woman that I adored killed herself in a head-on collision. And the woman that I called my mother, because I was so close to her in AA, I called her my second mother, died. And you know, I did not once think about drinking. I told you, I thought about dying. But not drinking. Ain't that something for an alcoholic? Why? Because sanity had been restored. That's what this program's all about. It's like everything else is icing on the cake, you know? The obsession to the drink was not there. Thank God for that. And as much as I hate to say it, all of this horror was good for me. It softened me. And it humbled me. And I got an ego the size of New York City. And it humbled me. And it made me closer to God than I've ever been in my life. And it scares me sometimes. Not long ago, my son's in the program now. He's 4 years sober this month. Full board doing good. He got up and introduced me at a meeting. He said, the man that's speaking to us tonight is the finest man I know. He's my hero. He's my father. This dad of mine who adored me and I adored him, you know, when I was 18 years old, a judge gave me a choice. You know, I could go to jail or go to service, and I got patriotic in a hurt. And Daddy took me down to put me on the bus for the Air Force, and while he was telling me how much he loved me, he had his hand planted firmly on my butt, pushing me up on that bus. He wanted me out of his life. And Daddy died with cancer, and I had the opportunity to sit with him and watch him suffer. And it was horrible, and it was blessed. The morning before he died, he rolled over and he says to me, am I going to die? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, when? I said, the doctor says real soon. Does that scare you? And he says, yeah. He said, I learned a long time ago, when you're afraid to give the fear to God, you go about your business. And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, son, I love you. You're one of the finest men I have ever known. Then not long ago, some people in the group, not just one, but three or four, said, you know, Tom, you're the sweetest, kindest, gentlest man we've ever known. When you hug us, you just ooze love. And I said, me? Yeah. Because I had hated me for so many years that if you told me you loved me, I'd give you 5 or 6 or 10 reasons why you shouldn't. If you told me I've done a good job, I'd give you 3 or 4 reasons why I should have done better. I was my own worst enemy my entire life. I treated me so bad, if anybody else had treated me that way, I would have killed them. My deepest defect of character was my own hate for me, which I projected on you. Think about it. I'm very careful now, because what I can pick out about you that I don't like, if I look very closely, I realize it's here. And it's just my shadow that I see. That's all. I thank God for this problem. I thank God for the drunks that put it together. I thank God for you. I don't even know you. You know, but I do. I may know some of you better than you know yourself. Just like my sponsor knew me better than I knew myself. And that's the way it's supposed to be. I'm not a preacher or a guru or a philosopher or anything. I'm a drunk. I got a heart full that I'm willing to share at any time to anyone who will listen. I've learned about love in this program. It's funny, in our country, love means a combination of hormones and emotions, you know. You see that stranger across the crowded room, you know, and she'd say, oh, a spiritual relationship. 6 months later, when the hormones drop, you wake up and look at her and say, who's this bitch? And you know, that's not the kind of love they're talking about in this program. They're talking about spiritual love. And spiritual love means responsible actions toward you based on care, respect, and concern for you and acceptance of you just as you are. It means I'll help you whether I like you or not. I may hate your guts, but I'm going to go out there and help you. The opposite of spiritual love is not hate. It is apathy. It is inaction. No action. It's taking what this program gives and sitting on your ass with it. And this is a program of love. Love creates. Nothing else creates but love. I'm a creation of love. You know that? And I was recreated by love. I was born and reborn in love. And I've been regenerated by love. And there ain't nothing else. And I'm light and I'm dark. And that's okay. And the moment it's okay with me is the moment God can move in and increase the light and decrease the darkness. So I try to get out of his way. What is God's will for me? It is to do the very best at what it is that I'm doing right now. I don't spend a lot of time wondering about what God's will is. Whatever it is I'm doing. If I'm driving a nail, I'm going to drive a good nail. Because life has to be simple for me. Now, I have a friend in Alabama who gave me a tape one time of a singer named Eddie Kilburn. And she said, this song on this tape reminds me of you. And I'd like you to listen to it. And I listened to it. And I'd like to close with it tonight as if it were a dialogue between me and my two daughters and my son and my mama. If I remember the words, I'd like to share this with you because it says a lot. My oldest daughter's named Crystal. She said, Daddy, why aren't you famous? I said, Crystal, I think I am. Because all the people you see here tonight came out here to give me a hand. But their applause isn't what really matters. It's what I can feel from their hearts. And if tonight I made dreamers of some who had lost them, or made friends with a few who were scared, or if there's one new believer who came here, a critic, and I told him that somebody cared, then Christy, I always feel famous. Though I'm not seen on TV, I get all the attention my ego can handle doing this live and for free. You see, I do it live. My daughter Frances says, Daddy, why are you lonely? And I said, Frances, I guess I am. because there are some people that I miss tonight who aren't here to give me a hand. But you know, in some ways they're closer than the people out on my front row. And if I'm quiet, I can hear Grumpy's heart beating with him and see Chuck C. driving his car. And there are preachers and poets that I never met, like Bill Wilson, who hasn't gone far. So I'm alone, but I'm not really lonely. I just got a group you can't see. They give me all the companionship my faith can handle doing this talking with me. You see, they do this talking with me. And Jason said, but Daddy, I think you're crazy. And I said, Jason, that's what keeps me sane. I was born with a strange sense of humor to go with a strong sense of pain. And I found that there's nothing so serious that it can't hold its own in the joke. So I may smile at stories about people suffering and laugh about losing my hat. Maybe people think I give talks without answers because I tease them and hide where they're at. But I also love things that are simple, and a smile is the last thing you'll see on the face of this crazy old outlaw, laughing out loud because I'm me. I laugh like this because I'm free. And my mother, the Southern Baptist, said, but Tommy, do you love Jesus? I said, Mama, doesn't it chill? She said, I've been listening to you for an hour, and frankly, I've got to say no. Because if you did, you'd be famous. Big concerts and Christian TV. You'd be so well known that you'd never get lonely, you'd never be crazy or weird, but you got to give up making talks without answers, and you ought to shave off that old beard. I said, I love you too, Mother. But you sure found it different than me. Because I do my best, and I do it like Jesus, because he did it live and free. Thank you.